Hello, learners, and welcome to Learn On Podcast, the science show by kids for kids. I'm your host, Jonsi, and I'm here today with a very special guest. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Absolutely. My name's Dr. Ami Bhatt. I'm a cardiologist. I live in Boston, Massachusetts, actually in Newton, right outside the city. And I'm the Chief Innovation Officer at the American College of Cardiology.
That's wonderful, and we're so happy to have you today. So first, I'm just curious in knowing a little bit more about your journey through your career. What steps led you to the position that you have right now, and what motivated you to focus on healthcare innovation specifically?
Yeah, so maybe we'll go way back for a second. Born in New York, raised in Jersey, went to public school, and then for 2 years moved to Pittsburgh with my family, where I ended up being in a private school for 2 years before I graduated. So interesting experience to see both public and private. Many of your listeners may be in one or the other or have tried both. And then I came up to Harvard for undergrad, went down to Yale for med school, and there was a day at Yale in med school where I was on a pediatric cardiology rotation. And we were called to the adult cardiology floor. And the way I remember it is we were walking in perfect V formation, our white coats flapping in the breeze as we arrived on the adult floor to help them with a patient. And it was someone who had grown up with pediatric cardiac disease and was now 30 years old. And the adult cardiologists who are used to seeing older people, heart attacks, et cetera, said, you know, we didn't really study this since med school. And we could use a pediatric cardiologist's help. And that field is now called adult congenital heart disease. And I picture that day as the day that really made me fall in love with it, although I think it was probably kind of a longer story than that. So that's what I went on to do. I did my medicine and pediatrics residency at Harvard. And then I did an adult cardiology fellowship and then a pediatric cardiology fellowship. And so I was practically 35 by the time I was done training. Don't strongly recommend, you know, being that old, but sometimes that's what you got to do if you love learning. And I really enjoyed my practice after that. I became an attending at Mass General Hospital and a professor at Harvard and enjoyed my work. And then my patients stopped coming to clinic because they were average age 28 and they came from Maine or Nantucket or upstate New York, Albany. And they didn't want to come 4 hours to talk to their doctor. And sometimes at those ages, you're just so busy with all of life. Some of them were having kids, they had a job. And it's just, you really lose a whole day. And what are you losing the day for? To talk to your doctor, but you're feeling pretty well for a check-in. And so actually many people at that age even stopped seeing primary care, but these guys were stopping seeing cardiology. And that was really, you know, the phrase is necessity is the mother of invention. My phrase is desperation is the mother of adoption. My patients were coming in and I had to figure out a way. And so I looked around for who was seeing patients at a distance and how, and found telemedicine. I asked for an extra license from someone else who was doing it. My institution, you know, at cardiology was not at the time. And they said, sure, we'll add you on. It was a stroke service. So they said, we'll just call you a neurologist. I said, great. And I started, and it was interesting. It was like really bad. The things were blurry. You would crash 7 times during a 20-minute conversation. Sometimes we had audio. Sometimes we were talking on a phone, but then using video to see each other. And it wasn't what we experienced more recently today, but it was a way for me to tell my patients, look, I hear you and I care. And the world does not revolve around the hospital in the big city. It should revolve around you. And so here I am for you. And they were really appreciative. I had no no-shows in my virtual clinic. I ran a Wednesday virtual clinic from 2013 to 2023. And I basically never had patients not show.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. And I think it's especially interesting to hear small details of your journey that resonate with me as well. Like, I've gone to a public school for most of my life, but my high school that I go to right now is private, and it's definitely been an interesting experience seeing that shift in education. And I also hope to go to medical school. So I definitely have a long journey ahead of me, but it was really nice to hear your story.
Well, it's a fun journey, that's for certain. And it's a constant love of learning, right? A love of learning, a curiosity for what's next. And if you had asked me when I was in undergrad, am I going to be a chief innovation officer someday? I'd be like, I don't really know what that is. And so, no, probably not. But that's how we, you know, we evolve over time.
Yeah, definitely. And we kind of talked about this slightly when you mentioned how you first became interested in digital health and telemedicine, but especially now post-pandemic, where telemedicine has become much more mainstream. And of course, there's much better platforms to do so and just more technology support with that. What has the perspective been like for you to see the landscape of virtual care kind of evolve over time? And maybe are there any particular advancements that you've noticed or just any notable moments throughout this trajectory?
The evolution has been remarkable. So there was some slow uptake in the kind of 2013 to 2019 realm, where we had some digital stethoscopes and we had handheld ultrasound. And we started to recognize in medicine that it wasn't enough to just look at someone on a camera from far away. You actually needed data. You needed a blood pressure cuff in their home that would upload via Bluetooth to an app that would then link to you, right? You would need maybe a stethoscope for a local cardiologist or primary care to be able to record a heart sound and then ask if specialists like me, does this sound the same, or use analytics on it. And so we started to do some of that work, but it wasn't until COVID that a lot of those companies had a significant acceleration. Because again, desperation leads to adoption. We had to find ways to care for people in the communities where they lived. And therefore, a lot of these technologies significantly took off, partly because venture capital firms and other people with finances recognized the importance and invested in these companies. And some of those companies did brilliantly and others didn't. And we learned a lot of lessons. But it was when we recognized that we needed to cross-collaborate, that we needed business people, and we needed tech companies and entrepreneurs, and we needed doctors and nurses and clinicians to all think together about how are we going to get care to our patients because we can't be in the hospital. So that acceleration was brilliant. And it's actually what led me to my current job because it was such an opportunity. I was outpatient director for the outpatient clinics at Mass General at the time that COVID hit. I had taken the job a couple years before. You guys might do this in your careers, right? Where you're doing one thing and you think, what's another step that I can take where I can expand my horizon, learn something new, take on more responsibility? I had taken this job. I told a lot of people, by the way, about the virtual clinic. I was like, this is great. Everyone should try it. Nobody ever tried it, dude. Like nobody tried it. No one was interested. And part of the reason is we didn't have a system. So it was like adding extra work to figure out how to do it. Plus the tech wasn't great. So nobody really wanted to do it until we had to. And so when COVID came, they said, hey, does anybody know how to get all our cardiologists onto virtual? Because we have to close our clinic. And that's 60,000 visits a year that wouldn't have happened. And fortunately, I was like, hi, you know, over here. And it was great. And it was really fun. There was a famous cardiologist. He passed away recently. His name was Dolph Hutter. My daughter, Mira, at the time was, I think, 12. And she was tech support because doctors would be calling me and asking for help. And I couldn't answer the calls fast enough. And I was trying to train some clinical research assistants because research had closed. So I was training them how to be support for virtual care, right? But I remember vividly one day where Mira at age 12 was saying, Uncle Dolph, in the top left corner is a green button. I need you to push the green button. And it was just very sweet because it really brought a lot of people together. But it also made me realize that the younger generation, including all of you, my daughter's probably about your age, she's a junior in high school now, you guys are digital natives. So all of this is going to also come easier to you. And we need to make sure it's part of your undergrad and med school and even earlier education to see that it evolves appropriately. And I think it's going to grow faster for you guys than it did for us. I'm sure of it. So I can't wait to see what happens.
I love how you touched on kind of the interdisciplinarity and the need for collaboration of experts from different fields. I think that's a consistent theme that we've seen throughout this season on the podcast, talking about the development of digital health and how it's not just healthcare professionals alone. We need the support of many different people with different skill sets to be able to successfully implement telemedicine. And of course, I also love your anecdote about your daughter. I think it's really easy as like a member of the younger generation to take for granted how much we're surrounded by technology compared to the perspective of people who have much more experience. And so it might not be as much of an instinctual shift to rely more on technology, but that's also especially why intergenerational collaboration is important as well to kind of make that transition more seamless.
Exactly right.
Yeah. And so you mentioned being the director of outpatient and telecardiology at Mass Gen. And so with advancing these telemedicine initiatives, were there any particular challenges that you faced and maybe successes that you achieved? Just thinking about problem solving, I know you touched upon like kind of getting people into this movement in the first place, but yeah, I'd love to hear more about that.
I think it's really important to think about the early lessons we learned in telemedicine when we're thinking now about digital health, remote monitoring, or even AI. So take, you know, the Apple Watch or a Fitbit or a Garmin, there's all this information coming in, right? And people bring this information and they bring it to their visits or they upload it through their electronic health record. As we're using AI, there's a ton of data out there and we can get tons of insights. But the problem we're about to face or we're facing now is really similar to what I faced when I was doing outpatient cardiology and tried to get people to do telemedicine. We didn't have an infrastructure for how the clinical workflow and the care of patients was going to include video visits. And that was inherently the biggest problem. There were people who were in the clinic seeing patients and then would have, oh, my 12 o'clock is on video, but then my 12:30 is in person. Well, just think about your regular life. How certain can you be that you're going to be able to call your mom at noon on any given day and be there and be ready and then get away from that call in time to do the next thing? It's very difficult in a busy life to make that happen. So then we tried virtual clinics and that worked better. I'm dedicating 3 hours to my day. I'm going to sit in front of the computer and I'm going to go from one person to the next. And so those were the little tweaks where we created an infrastructure that allowed for us to do the televisits and ended up being more successful. The same is now true for when we're going to use AI or even if we're going to use wearables as part of our healthcare system. We can't just have all of this data be thrown at us and then say, hey, clinicians, decide what to do. We need an infrastructure. We need to process that data. We need to know that it's good data, that we trust it. And we need to help clinicians understand who's reviewing it, where in their day are they reviewing it? How are they communicating to other people? And so infrastructure was my lesson from outpatient cardiology at Mass General and telecardiology. And it remains my lesson today as we now start to shift and think more about remote monitoring and the use of AI for population health.
Yeah, that's definitely a great aspect that we can work on and need to improve on that I hadn't thought about as much before. Of course, we've talked about like the reliance of data, which kind of becomes like a consistent concern as artificial intelligence is becoming more prominent that a lot of people have talked about, but really understanding what we're doing with that. And as you said, creating that infrastructure so that we're able to efficiently adapt to telemedicine is certainly something that's very important. And then also, I'm just kind of curious, I want to backtrack a little bit to something you said earlier. You mentioned how the world doesn't revolve around the hospital, it should revolve around the patients. And so I'm just curious how you can kind of tailor telemedicine solutions to patients who are coming from diverse backgrounds, maybe they're from rural areas, and how we can kind of use telemedicine to meet their specific needs.
So the most important thing I think to recognize is we often think that sitting with a patient in your office is the best care. We hold that up as the gold standard. Mm-hmm. And my challenge to people everywhere is it's not always the best standard depending on what the need is. So if I need to know your blood pressure because you are a hypertensive patient, your seeing me once a year in the office is actually perhaps the worst kind of care I can give you. But my being able to give you a blood pressure cuff and tell you parameters and have you use that at home, perhaps have someone who can digitally train you, perhaps use a grandkid who could train you. And then you do that rather regularly. And when there is an alert, you find out there's an alert or your local clinician knows there's an alert. And then we can do something about it. Hey, is this a trend? Do we need to change your medicine? Let's do that. And you can do that at the local pharmacy. That patient can now do that regularly as part of their life. Their healthcare has become not episodic, but continuous. And now we're actually able to get into places like rural America. If you think about how we get into some of these places, the big medical centers, yes, we have lots of outlying clinics, but at the end of the day, sometimes the CVSs and the Walgreens are the ones closest to you, right? Or the corner store or the local pharmacy, or even your community center where we do health fairs or check-ins. So we really need to use all of the resources we have in the communities where people live to be part of the healthcare system. We also need to use all the people in the community. We know that there's a shortage of physicians and nurses globally. We know that we're not going to be able to fill that shortage anytime soon. We're working on STEM. We're working on more kids going to med school, nursing school, PT. But we're not going to be there soon, and our older generation is going to continue to do better and live longer. So in the meantime, we need to expand our workforce. And part of that means thinking about the communities where people live, who could be a caregiver, and how do we best equip them with just enough knowledge to make sure that the data gets to the right place at the right time and our patients are safe, not expecting people to do too much, but also not assuming that they can't do anything. And I think that's probably the most important part of telemedicine is it's never video alone. It's never just a digital thing. It is the combination of humans plus technology and building, again, sorry, I'm going to sound like a broken record, the infrastructure out there to get it done.
Thank you for that answer. I think that this was especially enlightening because I've had so many conversations recently about telemedicine, and I feel like every time I learn something new. But I think you're the first person who's mentioned that it should be considered like not just restricting to the idea of logging onto a platform and just having a virtual visit. And it also really resonated with me when you said that we're able to make care continuous, not episodic, because I feel like in a lot of conversations about telemedicine, it's really easy to kind of frame it as the best alternative to that gold standard that you mentioned, and kind of thinking about it as a replacement or a secondary alternative for when a patient, for some reason, can't regularly come in and access in-person care. But now that you frame it that way, and I'm thinking about it, like it makes a lot more sense, especially for patients who have conditions that need to be regularly monitored, to be able to monitor it from home. And if anything, that has a higher quality of care and more accuracy because you're collecting more data points. So definitely haven't thought about telemedicine before in this way, but I'm very glad that you brought it up.
You know, there's two things. One is if you think about chronic disease, it's actually the majority of what we care for in this country and globally. It's not acute care. You feel like it's acute care because you hear about it and it's more costly. But if we did chronic care better and preventative medicine better, which requires care in the community where people live, we would likely both save in cost and save in cost to the patient in terms of morbidity or mortality. I'll tell you one story, though, that not directly about morbidity or mortality, but just gold standard. I had a patient, a young man, and he had a wife and three kids, dog, and he needed his third valve surgery. He was like only 30-something by that time. Maybe he had just hit 40. And I had to tell him because he had his ultrasound, and I was like, oh gosh. And so I insisted that he came in. This was very early in my journey with telemedicine. It might have even been maybe the first year that I was doing it. And he said to my administrative assistant, like, no, I'm not coming in. Have her do that virtual thing. And I said, no, I called her. I said, you have to come in. Now, of course, he knew because he was feeling unwell and he'd been through it twice before. So finally, he said, look, just do this first. I'll come in later. I said, fine. I was very worried about telling him over the video. He and his wife sat together on the couch. The kids were in the other room. You heard the dog barking from wherever they had locked the dog away.
Yeah.
And I told him, and we talked about what the next steps were, what the risk for surgery is now that it's the third time, what precautions we would take. And his wife said, thanks. She was a little teary-eyed and gave him a hug. She got up and he turned to me and he said, thank you. And I said, why are you thanking me? I just told you you need a third heart surgery. He goes, no, thank you for doing it over video because I know how uncomfortable you were. But if I'm going to, he called it go under the knife. I don't love that phrase, but it's what he said.
Yeah.
If I'm going to go under the knife a third time, I needed to be here with my wife and my kids in my home because they're the reason I'll do it a third time. And it was just such a change of my worldview, Jansi. That moment, I just realized, hey, I was practicing with myself as the clinician in mind as the center of this universe. I was not practicing thinking about him as the center of his universe. And I thought of myself as like a pretty good doctor who really appreciates their patients. But it was a real great change in worldview. It was really thinking about what he needed. That's the thing he needed. And that was really important to him. So again, just goes back to, you know, what is the gold standard? It's what the patient needs.
That's, yeah, an incredibly powerful story. And especially, I guess, with people who have chronic medical conditions, it can be very difficult to have to keep going back to the hospital in a place where it's kind of associated with negative memories or with fear about what the future holds. And so having telemedicine as the option to be in a more comfortable and safe environment when you have to hear difficult news or make hard choices about the future and assess things like risk, and especially with a complicated surgery, I can only imagine how much comfort it would bring the patient to be with their family in their home. And so again, like you said, redefining the gold standard, telemedicine can definitely have so many benefits that in-person visits cannot. So,
no, exactly right. I love that you point out that the hospital can have tough memories, because that's so true. I once had a patient who said the smell of the hospital was a trigger for her. She would panic at the smell of a hospital. And so, you know, there are a lot of things that we don't necessarily think about if we're fortunate enough to not have to chronically be, you know, under care.
Of course. And like a common theme that pops up when we're talking about telemedicine and artificial intelligence and all of these technology-driven initiatives in medicine is the worry that we're not able to connect with our patient enough, or that it somehow, as in the integration of technology, somehow takes away that aspect of being human. But as we have established here, it can sometimes even further strengthen that connection and help doctors to approach a situation with a newfound empathy or different perspective for the patient scenario. So it's definitely that we have telemedicine as one of the many options for.
Yeah. At noon today, I gave grand rounds to the Mass General Hospital MedPeds residents.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things we talked about is this new idea of voice to text in AI, which is, you know, based on large language models, but it's the idea that you can have a conversation with your patient, and then there are these companies that will take that and turn it into a note for you. And I will tell you, the room lit up at the idea that we might actually be able to start it for residents soon, because the amount of time they spend with their back to a patient typing into a computer, and then you can imagine the opinion of the patients about a new young doctor who won't make eye contact with them, which is the way they see it. It's really hard. You've worked your whole life to finally have your own clinic, and now your patients don't see you as the doctor you really want to be. So both in terms of administrative burden, AI will do a lot to help decrease that burnout rate, administrative burden, but also just how you feel about yourself. You don't want to be a typist. You want to be a doctor, and it enables us to do that.
Yeah, again, establishing human connection.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, these were some great stories that we talked about, and it was wonderful to hear your unique perspective on telemedicine, having had experience with it years before the pandemic. And so just one final question to kind of close things up. What do you see as the future of advancing digital patient care, especially with your role in cardiovascular health? And I guess just how do you see yourself in the future leveraging these technologies to enhance patient care even further?
I think what we're going to do, you know, people used to call it the last mile problem, which is, you know, getting to those patients after they leave a hospital and go home. And the way I think about it is actually the first mile problem, which is healthcare begins in the home. It always has. And we, over the years, as science advanced, technology advanced so quickly, whereas our infrastructure for care delivery, for education, for, you know, whatever you name it, that didn't advance as quickly. And so we became very hospital centric. And so I think our ability to take large amounts of data to do remote monitoring is going to be able to help us push care back in the community, where you start in the home, you monitor in the home, you come in just a step closer, right out of your home. Sometimes if you need care or people enact care in your home, there's a lot of care at home programs right now. And then if you need something, yes, you can come to an institution, but when you do, you get the right clinician and the right test at the right time because we saw it coming. So I think we go back to this: continuous care means we're supporting health. Episodic care means we're treating disease. And I really want to see us in a framework where we look back and say digital health and AI enabled us to care for patients' health rather than just treat people's disease. And I think that's where, you know, where we're going to see ourselves get if we do it right.
Yeah, again, I am absolutely enchanted by the idea of considering the hospital as just one part of a piece in a holistic kind of overview or a plan. And that, again, I'm sure helps more with preventative care and just generally tailoring to the patient's needs. So this really opened my eyes and kind of taught me to see telemedicine in a new way. So I'm so glad that you were able to join us, and I'm sure our listeners agree as well.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And I love that you do this podcast. This is fabulous.
Of course. Thank you so much.